Welcome to The Wonder, exploring perspectives, rituals, and observances of modern, naturalistic, earth-revering, pagan religious paths. Here are your hosts, Yucca and Mark.
Welcome back to The Wonder, science-based paganism. I'm your host, Mark.
And I'm Yucca.
And today we are going to talk about death. It's Hallows season, Samhain, Halloween season. And this is the time when we contemplate our mortality and address all the various issues that that raises, because they are many and complex. And so we're going to dive into that today. This can be a challenging topic for some folks. So content warning, we're going to talk about, very frankly, about dead bodies and preparations for dying and funerals and all that kind of stuff. So if that isn't really where you want to be right now, then I encourage you to not listen to this episode.
That being said, though, I'm actually quite excited about this one. We'll get into some of that practical stuff, but also we wanted to start with, what are our perspectives on death? What's the role of it? What is death? Are you gone when you die? You know, what is you? So we can't really talk about death without also talking about, what is it to be alive? What is it to be a person?
Yes. Yes. And one of the things that I really appreciate about paganism is that, at least many flavors of paganism, is that they are willing to encounter big issues like this, issues like death and sex and so forth, in a very frank way. And so it's one of the things that I appreciate about my pagan practice, that there's a time of year when I can come back around to revisiting my mortality, as well as the observances that I do around the course of the year with my underworld altar that I posted to the blog about this week. So why don't we start with those perspectives on death? Yucca, what do you think about death?
Well, death is absolutely necessary. Because without death, nothing else gets to live. Mm-hmm. So, and we can come at that from so many different perspectives, just in terms of there being the resources. Death is about resource cycling. Matter, there's a limited amount of it. If we take a look at Earth, we can say that roughly, there's the same amount of stuff that makes up Earth as there was 4.5 billion years ago. Yes, we have some space junk falling. You know, we've got dust and comets that we pick up each year, but that's tiny in comparison to what the planet, what we are made from. And if the stuff that lived 3 billion years ago, if they didn't die, well, there'd be nothing to make the stuff that lived 2 billion years ago, and nothing to make the 1 billion. And now there wouldn't be anything for us to be made from. Matter has to cycle.
Yes.
It goes from one form to another to another. And each time it transitions, there is death.
Yes.
And even our daily life, there, how many deaths, how many cells of yours? Each cell is an individual living thing. It died so that there could be new cells. And the same thing on a different scale.
Sure, sure.
So, yeah.
As well as all of the lives that we take simply by eating. Whether they're vegetable or animal, we're still killing something by consuming food.
Yeah, or our immune systems, or...
Yes. And even in theory, if you were only eating fruit or something, so that the progenitor organism was still alive, the tree was still alive, but we were only eating fruit, you're still killing cells. you're still taking something that's alive and cycling it back into yourself to make your own constitution.
Well, and that's only taking one step away anyways, because the tree is growing in soil, and soil is a bunch of dead things eating stuff, and then living things eating those dead things and eating other living things. Life, the complex ecosystems that we are a part of, are built upon death.
Exactly so. As I've said before, death is not only the law, it's a good idea.
Yes. Without that, we'd run out very quickly. And then there's death anyways.
Then all of life is gone, and you have capital D death, like you do on Mars. At least we think. There may be a left on Mars, but...
I'd put money on it, personally.
Okay.
I'd love to... We should come back to astrobiology, but I'd be absolutely shocked, given the conditions of the Noachian period, and given the continuing conditions, very unlikely that it's right there on the surface in the top few centimeters. Sure. Very hostile, but there's a lot of environment on Mars that is pretty prime for life.
Sure, it's wet and salty.
Yeah.
And, well, it's entirely possible. But in any case, it's very likely that there's multicellular life on Mars.
There's certainly not surface life in the multicellular surface life in the way that we experience it here on Earth.
Yes, yes. On this, we agree. So, death, it performs a very important role in our ecosystems. It's a necessary component of the cycling of matter and energy throughout the system of the biosphere. Mm-hmm. And so to deny it, or to be phobic about it, or to hedge in our views, is doing a disservice to the very amazing systems that give rise to us.
Yeah.
Which brings, you know, go ahead.
I was going to say that reminds me of a thing that I think that we do on a large cultural scale in this phobia of death, is that we confuse death with cruelty or suffering.
Yes.
That those two, although things can die in a way that does cause them to suffer, or there are ways to kill that are cruel, not all death is cruel or suffering.
Yes.
That it can really lead to, well, it leads to new life. It leads to birth. It can lead to joy.
And it can lead to the end of suffering. It's, you know, there are people, many people, who get to a point where they're ready to go. And it's a release for them to be allowed to die. So I wanted to talk a little bit about monism, which is the philosophical principle that there is no difference between the personality / spirit / soul, etc., and the body, that the personality is an emergent property of the brain and central nervous system, and that without a brain or a central nervous system in good operating order, that personality goes away. This is not the mainstream opinion in our society. The mainstream opinion is all about there being a soul that continues or reincarnates or goes through lessons and then leaves the wheel of karma. There's lots of different ways of looking at it.
It's not unique to just one religion. It's many different religions that... Yeah.
Precisely so. And I can understand the impulse for why people would choose to cling to a belief like that, because it's a get out of death free card. It's a way of not having to confront the fact that they will end one day. But personally, I don't subscribe to any of those philosophies. I don't see any evidence for them. I don't see any reason why evolution would ever have created them. A human personality is an information pattern, a self-programming, evolving information pattern with constant new inputs coming in from the senses. And that information pattern must be held within a matrix, and the matrix is the brain. When the brain fails, the information pattern is disrupted and no longer functions. And then that energy, which does persist, energy is never created or destroyed. It radiates away as heat. It no longer has structure as information. It simply radiates away as heat. The body grows cold, and then the person is gone. So, fair warning, that is the perspective that I bring to this conversation about death. And I think it's the one that's most consistent with the available evidence. I also think it's one that helps to come to grips with death in a way that is more productive than scrambling to try to achieve brownie points in order to get to some future afterlife or something like that, which honestly strikes me as a way to waste a lot of the life that you have here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That perspective is one that we share most certainly.
Yeah, I thought so. Now, embracing that idea, especially if you come from a background of having had a different view, it's a sobering moment. It's a very kind of solemn recognition of I was born, that information pattern began to evolve and self-program. It gathered information. My personality has evolved, and there's a lot of genetic predisposition in that. There's also a lot of environmental influence that goes into that to make us the people that we are. And that process is going to go on, and then at a certain point, it's going to stop. And there will be no more us. I'm reasonably comfortable with that prospect because it occurs to me that for 4.5 billion years, I was dead. There was no me. I was not aware. I was not suffering. I was not in pain. I was not.
Yeah.
After I die, I'll be in exactly the same situation. I will be non-existent, and I will exist only in the memories of others and in the works that I have done in the world. Mm-hmm.
One other form, which is a little interesting to think about. You mentioned that heat.
Yes.
We're releasing photons.
Mm-hmm.
And those will keep going until they hit something else and they get absorbed. But until they do, our little photons are just flying out there in space.
Yes, yes.
And who knows how far they'll get.
Yes, a bubble, a wave, in fact, of event.
Yeah.
Out into space. And who knows, maybe somebody... some creature out there has a sensitive enough detector to be able to see that when it goes by.
Yeah.
Oh. Well,
maybe they won't see it, but if they live in a world like ours and they're standing outside one day and might hit their face,
mm-hmm.
they're basking in their warm double sun or whatever it is that they have. Just tickles me to think about that. But
I like that too.
But me, you, as humans, as us, as a person, as people, we had our turn and we're gone.
Yes.
And that material is still part of the earth and is cycling around. And that little carbon atom that right now is my finger, well, that's going to be in a bird and going to be in a bacterium over here. And it's going to keep going.
Exactly so. And that's a good thing. It's not good for us individually, but it's good for the system. And I worship the system. I revere the system. That is what I hold most sacred, is life on Earth and the incredible unfolded cosmos. So it's, you know, to me, it's kind of like the final act that I will do is sort of a vote for the system. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's like, okay, here, I've had this amazing ride. I've been able to be me and do all these things and experience all this stuff. Now, here are the raw materials that I was made of. Make something else.
Yeah.
So why don't we talk a little bit about death in the context of preparation? Because this is the only experience that every human being is promised. Even those that die before they're born receive a death. So it's kind of on us to be prepared for this. It's important.
Before we hit the record button, you were saying that we do have a general cultural discomfort in discussing death, which made a very good point that just because we talk about it isn't going to make it more, it's not going to make it happen right away, right?
Yes, there's a sort of superstitious fear around talking about death, thinking about death. And my joke has always been, just like talking about sex doesn't make anybody pregnant, talking about death doesn't make anybody die. I'm encouraged to see that there are movements contrary to that superstitious fear happening in our society now. There are death cafes where people go to talk about their feelings about death, their experiences of death. And of course, there's the wonderful work being done by the Order of the Good Death and Caitlin Doty, who has her amazing YouTube channel, Ask a Mortician, which demystifies the process of death a lot and normalizes it as a part of human experience. Mm-hmm. So, okay, we understand what death is. We're confronting that it's going to happen. So, yes. So, knowing that we're going to die, we have some choices. We have choices about how to live our lives, and we have choices about how we die. Now, we don't have absolute choice in how we die, but most people have at least a little bit of a say about how they die. Now, if they die by accident or very suddenly, then they won't. But even then, they can have a say about how their body is disposed of, what kind of rituals are done around that, what they like in their obituary, all those kinds of things, if they do the preparation in advance. Mm-hmm. And as we were saying, yes, it can be a little scary to address your impending death in that kind of way on paper, but you're doing your loved ones a tremendous favor by doing this, because let's face it, when people are grieving, when they're in mourning, they do not want to go fishing through your papers to look for your life insurance policy number, if they're even aware that you have a life insurance policy.
If you do,
yes. I have a relatively small one for Nemea, my partner, because she doesn't work, she's disabled. And I want, if I'm not able to be a breadwinner, I don't want her to be left with nothing. So what I do is I have created what I call my death packet. And my death packet is a set of papers, which includes advanced directives for care. So, you know, if for example, I end up in a state where it's unlikely that my brain function is ever going to recover, and I'm on life support, I want to be taken off that life support. I am not interested in being an artificially maintained vegetable at unbelievable expense. So, I mean, those resources are better applied to people that have a chance to recover, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So, I have this death packet. I have it both printed out physically and in a place where my loved ones know where it is. And I also keep a copy of it on the desktop of my computer, little skull icon. And the title of the file is "In Case of My Death," so that somebody can get into my computer and they will have access to a farewell letter that I've written, instructions about how I would like to die if I'm given the choice. You know, I'd rather die at home. I'd rather be surrounded by my pagan witchy stuff. Here's the kind of music that I like. I like a little incense now and again, you know, all those sorts of things, because most of us don't die immediately. And we do have some choices about the conditions under which we die. So articulating those for the people that would be implementing them is very helpful. Yucca, I know you have also put together these kinds of instructions.
Yeah, so not to the same level of detail that it sounds like you have, but my partner and I do have children. And so actually up until having kids, we didn't have anything. I mean, I had a beneficiary on my bank account, right? Mm-hmm. It was like, you know, they made me put one on, so I just put my brother on when I was signing up. But now that we have kids, the very real discussion of, you know, hopefully nothing ever would happen to both of us at the same time, but if something does, who do we want to take our kids?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Who's going to take care of them? And even if something didn't happen to both of us, if something happened to one or the other, it's still important to have a will. And that, so that's all, that's really all we have in my state. It's very, very simple. You just need it to be in writing. You've got to have it witnessed. It doesn't have to be notarized. It doesn't have to be in a certain format. Different states are different, but it's pretty easy to find out what your state does, or your country, or wherever you're listening from. It's just a simple internet search to find that. But for us, it's on our driver's license, and it's in a statewide database that we're organ donors. And then we have a fireproof safe where we've got copies of the stuff that we would need that we can grab if we ever had to evacuate. And it's in there with, okay, well, what happens with the kids? You know, what happens with any of the other, any resources or material things that we have? And knowing that we were going to do this episode, we actually, this earlier this week, went ahead and took a look at it and went, okay, is everything's up to date? We had another kid. That kid's name is in here too. A couple of years back, I came across my parents' wills, and my the closest brother and I weren't even in them, because the last time they had updated it was before we were even born. I mean, I'm sure my father has since, because my mother passed when I was pretty young, but I found the wills before that point and they hadn't updated it. So it was kind of a point for us to be like, yeah, okay, make sure that we go through every year or every few years and make sure everything's there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Are there new things that we need to address?
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a copy of that at his mother's home, where she's got others, you know, so that it's in two different places.
Sure.
So if something were to happen at our place, well, there's a second location where there would be copies of the documents. So that's from a practical place where we come at it from.
That's very sensible. Very sensible indeed. Do you also have advanced directives?
We do not have those at this point. That is on the list of one of the, what we could do. I mean, we've talked with each other about our general desires, but have not written that down. And so that would probably be a next step, is to get those in order.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about, for our listeners, what that is? If there's...
Sure. An advanced perspective is a set of medical instructions to your caregivers about what circumstances you would like life-saving intervention to happen or not. Mm-hmm. For some people, they want every last thing done to keep them alive to the very, very end, no matter how extreme. That might
change over the years. They might want that when they're 30, but not when they're 80.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Others, like myself, if there's a reasonable chance that I'm actually going to recover and be myself, then by all means, let's have some medical care and get better. If not, if I'm going to be some radically impaired version of myself, particularly mentally, then I don't want that life-saving intervention. I would rather be allowed to die. Because for a lot of reasons, both for my own experience and because of, you know, being a burden on my partner and just not wanting to be in that kind of situation. And it's a personal choice and there are no right and wrong answers. People just have to make those choices known, because if you're incapacitated, someone else will. Very helpful to have advance directives in advance. All of this sounds a little daunting, I know. I mean, I've been listing all these different documents that's in my death packet and stuff, but there is good news. On the atheopaganism.org blog, there is a post which has a downloadable workbook that you can go through that will capture all of that information. All of the stuff, you know, who do we call in the case of your death? What are the passwords to your various social media accounts and your, you know, online banking and all that kind of stuff? So obviously you need to keep this secure because you don't want people just, you know, emptying your bank account or whatever. But if you go through this workbook, at the end, you will have a document that includes your will and all those different pieces. You'll need to get some signatures on some of them. And as long as you have that in a safe place or in multiple places, and you have let people know about it, you're covered. You can, and we're going to talk in a minute about sort of the nuts and bolts of death. You can stipulate, well, I want to be cremated, or I want to be buried, or I want the bells and whistles funeral with the $10,000 casket and to be embalmed so that I will last forever in some horrifying suspended state. Not that I have opinions about this. You know, you get to make those choices. And honestly, you know, your death is yours. It's a guarantee, as I said before. It's something that you own. And you can make it yours. You can shape it the way that you want to be, at least in terms of what happens with your body afterwards. You may not be able to decide how you die, but you can decide what people are going to do with you when you have died. Mm-hmm.
And so that link, I'll go ahead and put that in the show notes if people want to go ahead and click on that and take a look. And even if it's something that you already have documents in order, it might be interesting just to take a look and see if there are things that you didn't think about or if you want to come back to it. Mm-hmm. But I think this is really a wonderful time of year to think about this. To come back to this in this hollow season, in this season where we are honoring and celebrating the death.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, I've spoken about this before a little bit. It's very common in pagan circles to talk about the cycle of holidays around the course of the year as the wheel of the year. Because it rolls around every year. Once again, we have this cycle of 8 holidays. And I really enjoy celebrating the wheel of the year. And of course, with every passing year, I go through that cycle again, but I tend to think of it more as the arc of the year, because I think of that cycle of holidays as a metaphor for the phases of a human life. And so when we get to Hallows or Samhain or Halloween or whatever you want to call it, that's the celebration of death. It's the acknowledgement of our mortality, the memory of those who have gone before. We're going to talk about ancestors in an upcoming episode, so we'll talk about that a lot more then. And this time of year becomes an opportunity to just revisit those documents again, to kind of self-examine to determine whether my thoughts have changed. I know that my farewell letter has changed a lot over the course of the years, both in terms of who it's addressed to and who gets acknowledged, and the things that I want to say about my experience of having lived my life. That's a moving target, and it's helpful to me to be able to write that and know that I get to say the things that I want to say to the people that I leave behind.
Mm. Out of curiosity, do you delete the old version?
I delete the old version. I think the initial document was in Word 3 or something like that. I've updated it to the modern format, but this has been rolling for quite a while.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, because I was going to say, what a book that would be if you had every version.
That's true. That's true. On the other hand, I really don't want this published until I'm dead, so maybe not.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the practicalities of death. All right. We know we're going to die. We can do these preparations. Hopefully our wishes are fulfilled and we have the kind of dying experience that we want, and we're able to communicate with our loved ones all the things that we want to say, either before or after we go. The dealing with our physical possessions is handled. As I sometimes joke, there's the question of, after the party, what do you do with the leftovers? Because there's this body to deal with, right? And we have very, very strong visceral feelings about dealing with dead bodies. And some of that is the death phobia in our culture.
Some of that is instinctual safety.
It is.
Right.
It is. Particularly when bodies begin to decompose, the smell of decomposing meat is programmed into us as something disgusting because we don't want to eat it. It's bad for us.
Yeah.
So, there are all these phenomena that conflate to give us a very, and then of course there is the sort of awe-inspiring and in some cases shattering realization that the person is not in there anymore, that this is real and they're gone and this is death and we are in the presence of it. So I have a lot of thoughts about how I would like my body to be dealt with and what kinds of funeral arrangements I would like, what kind of ritual activities I would like to have happen. What about you, Yucca? Have you had any thoughts about this at all?
Yeah, a little bit. I certainly do not want any sort of open casket stuff like that. I had often assumed that I would just do a cremation and have my ashes spread. But to be honest, I haven't really researched the cremation process to say, is this something I actually want to be involved in or not? It was at the time of my mother's death in 99, green burials were not legal in our area.
Uh-huh.
And that was sort of that was what she chose, the closest thing, so that her ashes could be on our land. And I've always liked that idea because I went, oh, well, then my ashes could get spread into the compost, into the land. Then it is really a returning to, my body gets to be the final version of my body, because what's been my body, there's a lot of material that once was my body, but whatever the final bit of my body is, I like the idea of it really returning to that part of the cycle.
That particular land.
Yeah. Now, green burials are legal in my area, and it's something I haven't really researched. I'm sure that there's restrictions about depth of burial and all kinds of things like that. And part of me also would just like it to be, to be as easy on my family as possible.
Sure.
Right. I don't want them having to be out there with shovels or hiring a backhoe or something like that. And so the cremation thing just always leans, you know, is attractive, but I don't know what they're using. So that's some research that I need to do.
Uh-huh. Well, have I got news for you? green burials tend to be about 3 to 4 feet deep. They're not, totally. They're not as deep as typical cemetery burials, where there are concrete liners put into the ground. And then of course, caskets as well. It's most common in a green burial for someone simply to be wrapped in cloth. They may be wrapped in a carpet or in a shroud, something like that. And you would be surprised at how powerful and moving it can be to actually be out there with shovels digging a grave for your loved one. There is a feeling of giving service and honoring the person who has died that is really extraordinarily powerful. I mean, I have buried a person with my hands, you know, scooped the dirt, you know, into the hole. And it felt very, very right.
Mm.
So it's really just a matter of, you know, what you want. For me, cremation is sort of a second option, or really a third option, because it releases a tremendous amount of carbon into the atmosphere, and it consumes a tremendous amount of energy.
Yeah.
So its footprint is pretty big. Mm. So I would prefer simply to decompose and then be recomposed into other things. There is a new process that is legal in some states. I know Washington, it's legal, and it's going to be legal in California starting in 2022, called alkaline hydrolysis. And essentially what this is heating a solution of water and lye up to about 300 degrees, and the body is dissolved into it. What remains are bone fragments, which are ground up to be like ashes in cremation, so you can spread them in the same mm-hmm. way that you do. The liquid is neutral. It's actually nutritious. It's got quite a lot of nitrogen in it. So it can be used in irrigation. It can be used, it can be just run into a city sanitation system. Can be used on a garden, any of those things. It consumes much less energy, and it's kind of a happy medium, in my opinion. But given the option, I would prefer to be buried, which of course involves paying for a burial plot and all that kind of stuff.
If you don't have land, right?
Yes. Well,
in California, can you be buried
in private land?
On private land? Okay.
Can't. Can you in New Mexico? Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. California has 40 million people in it, and they probably don't want all these little suburban plots having having bodies in the backyard. It might make life really complicated for police when every time somebody puts in a swimming pool, they dig up three bodies.
There's paperwork involved with it, though. You have to like tell the state where.
I see.
Where you're doing that. And yeah.
I see.
But we tend to be a little less, our population is lower and our cultural attitude towards state intervention and regulations is very different.
Sure. Of course. So there are three basic categories of ritual around death that I'm aware of, and they are the treatment of the body itself, mm-hmm. you know, the actual, and that can include a viewing, and, you know, you just put the person into bed and, you know, light a little incense in case there are any decomposition smells, and they can be there, especially if you put like dry ice or ice packs on the body. Mm-hmm. They can last for 2-3 days before there's any significant decomposition. And that can often be a wonderful thing for the community to come by and see the person and talk to them and so forth. There's a little trick that I know. If you roll up like a hand towel and put it under the chin, then the mouth doesn't fall open, because that can be sort of disturbing for people. Mm-hmm. The treatment of the body itself. Oh, I should jump back to this. The funeral industry would like for you to believe that you need to have a funeral home pick up the body at the coroner, for example, and transport it to wherever it's going. That is not true. You have a right to pick up your loved one and transport them yourself and manage the body yourself. You do not have to have a funeral home do that. In fact, you can do that process of having a viewing in your home and all that kind of thing, and then give the body to a funeral home for cremation or for some other service.
In your state, does the body have to go to a coroner's?
No, depending on the death. If it's an accidental death, then it goes to the coroner because they have to determine the cause of death. That is, of the deaths that I have had in my life, the most vivid and profound experience that I had of funerary rites was a little boy who had drowned. And so he had to go to the coroner and have an autopsy and all that kind of stuff.
But if it's your cancer patient in bed, they can just get a sign off from a doctor.
Yes, there's a death certificate. You still, at least in California, you need a permit to transport human remains, mm-hmm. Which you can get at your coroner's office. You just go and you present the death certificate, and they give you the thing, and you take a station wagon or a van or whatever it is, and you know, you go and take the body. For many people, for many families, and this is true in certain cultures as well, I know the Roma people and Mennonites and Amish are really focused on treating the body, that the family handling the body. Mm-hmm. In the case of this little boy that I'm talking about, we brought him home and we put oil on him and we wrapped him in silk and then laid him out and talked to him and read him poetry and sang him songs and all that kind of cathartic funerary behavior. And then when the time came, we put him in a box and buried him. The reality of death, the fact of death, becomes so much more concretized in this way. There's a way that people can just be sort of disappeared by death in our mainstream culture. They die, they get taken away by a funeral home, then there's this box, but you don't really see the person, and then the box goes into the ground or whatever, and you can kind of imagine that they're still wandering around out there somewhere, that that they're still alive. The fact that they've died becomes much more real when you deal with the body. Mm-hmm. So that's the first sort of ritual activity that you can do, is the actual management of the body. And then you can have a viewing and you can have a ritual around that, with the poetry and the songs and whatever other, and awake. I'm a big believer in parties, so I really want people to have a party and they can do what people do at wakes, which is tell stories about the person who has died. And some of them are funny stories and some of them are sad stories and some of them are embarrassing stories. And that's just the recollection of a life. It's good. Mm-hmm. So then the next step beyond a ritual that actually involves the presence of the dead person, is a graveside ritual, which of course you can't do if you're cremating or, you know, some other kind of treatment. There is something very profound about lowering someone into the ground. I'm very glad that we did it by hand with straps under the body so that we could lower her down into the ground, as opposed to having some mechanical thing where you flick a switch and the thing lowers and all that kind of thing. And then, you know, raking all that dirt in on top of the person, it feels very final and very sorrowful. I mean, it's so, so sad. But it also feels right. We come from this earth. We are of this earth. We return to this earth.
Well, it's certainly not the same act, but with other methods, you still can have ceremonies that play that role or represent, like the cremation, you know, actually going to a mountaintop and letting the ash blow away. Yeah. Or I'm again not sure on the legality of it, but taking it to the ocean.
Apparently there is a big problem in Disneyland. secretly throwing ashes in, and they've had to like stop entire rides so that they can get people with hazmat suits out to clean, which is stupid because there's no health danger from cremains.
Yeah. But I mean, you don't want to breathe that in, but not, there's yeah. certainly no pathogens that you're worrying about with that. Yeah.
But apparently this is a big problem and there are signs everywhere, no scattering of ashes. And apparently for some people, this was their happy place and where they wanted to stick around.
I can, you know, not my happy place, but I can understand where that's coming from. Right. Yeah.
Yes, I agree. You can do an ash scattering ceremony that has that same finality. You can bury ashes, mm-hmm. and, you know, do that same sort of ritual. The disposal of remains is something that we've been doing since before we were human. There are Neanderthal burials that have pollen all over them from flowers that were apparently scattered over the top of those burials. And it's something profoundly human to do. And then the third kind of funerary rite that we can do is a memorial ceremony. And people sometimes do these a month, 2 months, even 3 months after the death. The body has been disposed of, but this is an opportunity for all who cared about the person to travel from distances and so forth and have a memorial at which stories are told, memories are shared, Songs are sung, music is offered, poetry is offered, and so forth, to help the community at large come into more of a sense of comfort with the fact that this person is gone. Those three different kinds of rituals are all, there are some guidelines for them spelled out in the Aethiopagan Clerics Introductory Guidebook, which will be published soon by the Aethiopagan Society. And there's just some guidance in there about working with the dying, working with the grieving, stuff like that, because people that choose a clerical role in the world are going to have to do that. That's when your people need you.
Yeah.
And then there is great silence when the death is over, when all of the various rites have happened. And that actually can be the time when the grieving most needs support, because you can keep yourself occupied with funeral arrangements and greeting visitors and throwing a wake and all those different kinds of things. But when the door closes and the last guest has gone and then you're alone, you're no longer with that person, that can be a very, very hard time. And so it's important for us to remember that and to continue to support people that are in the state of grief.
Yeah. And then for everyone else, you know, life goes on and it continues, often that next time of year. And the grief is never, it's not something you ever get over or that it's ever gone, but you learn to live with it.
Yes, exactly so. One of the prejudices of our culture is to try to be problem solving about all suffering. And this is not universal. I mean, there's a major school of religion, Buddhism, which is all about learning to live with suffering, learning to sit with it and to transcend suffering by acceptance and equanimity. But in our society, we tend to want to solve problems. And so we tend to think of grief as a problem to be solved. And it isn't. It's just a process to go through. And when you lose someone that you love, the sting of that will not go away. It will just subside to a dull ache when you remember that the person is gone. But if it's someone who was very close to you in the early phases after that loss, it is the largest fact of your world. And it can become profoundly impactful on your mental health, on your capacity to function, on your executive functions in your brain, your ability to organize thinking and remember things and so forth. The very, very powerful impact. And so compassion for the grieving and helping as you can and as that person wants you to, and then not helping as they don't want you to, is very important. Mm-hmm. It just occurred to me, I wanted to say something about pets. Many people have a sort of denigrating opinion about people's experience of the death of pets. You know, well, they weren't people really. That's not true. Pets are members of our families. We invite them into our households. We feed them. We love them. We.
They're not humans, but they're people.
Yes.
They really are.
They have personalities. They're unique in those personalities. And when they die, we experience a terrible loss. There's a hole in our household that is left. And so I would just say that all of these things that we've been talking about in terms of working with the body, graveside burial, probably not a memorial ceremony. I don't see gathering several hundred people to mourn Fluffy, but you may.
I went to a service dog's service, yeah, though, and there weren't hundreds, but it was quite profound.
Wow. I could definitely see that. I mean, a service dog performs such incredible role in the life of the person that they serve. I mean, that's like losing an arm. It's, you know, such a loss of part of you. So be aware that, you know, these things that we're saying about death and the impact of death and ways to process death, it is not silly or trivial to want to acknowledge the death of an animal in your life in the same way that we do a human.
Yeah. It's not about what species somebody is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We're both sitting here with our cats.
Yes. Who, mine, I don't know if you spotted, but he was trying to bite me and play with me while I was talking about very large emotional things. Yes.
Cats are pretty good at sussing out when you're feeling strong emotions. They will, they'll come and sort of bug you and see whether you're all right.
Yeah. This one likes to knock things off the table to get my attention. He's like, pay attention to me knocking things off the table instead of whatever that is that you're dealing with.
Well, listen, I think this has been a pretty thorough exploration. I'll remind people once again, you know, if the link to the workbook will be in, or the post that has the link to the workbook will be in the podcast notes. But if you're just listening and you're driving or something like that, and you don't have access to those notes, you can go to atheopaganism.org and in the search bar, type "A Gift from the Dying," and that will take you to the post. A Gift from the Dying at atheopaganism.org.
And thank you for putting that together, Mark.
I can't take full credit for it. I modified something that was put together by the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids in the state of Maine. Mm-hmm. I found it online and then added things and made adjustments. But it's a very valuable piece of work. I'm so grateful to have found it. So, embrace life. It's short. It ends. Hope that you've all enjoyed this kind of somber topic for our impending Hallows season. And we'll be back next week to talk about something else really cool here on The Wonder, Science-Based Paganism. If you'd like to get in touch with us, we have an email address. That is thewonderpodcastqs@gmail.com. Once again, that's thewonderqs@gmail.com. And thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, everyone.